Live. Hello everybody and welcome to the ABCs of Green Politics, part of the Left Bloc Political Education Project, which includes the excellent trademark Belfast, A Worker's Guide to Everything, a left-wing analysis of the newspapers The Week at Work with David Gibney, an Irish language broadcast, Nulla Nog, and this particular broadcast, the ABCs of Green Politics. I'm John Barry. I'm going to be your host for this evening. And we have two guests that are going to be discussing with us tonight. N is for the news. And we have Niall Sargent and we have Shauna Corr. And I'll allow them to introduce themselves in a moment. I'm really looking forward to this, not least since, certainly for me as a long-time activist and academic, I've been pulling my hair out at the way the news, or at least mainstream media, have been covering ecological and climate issues. So I'm really looking to hearing what both Shauna and Niall have to say on their experience, what they see as some of the issues, particularly in terms of framing the ecological and climate challenges that we face, and also why we talk more about the challenges than the opportunities. You know, we seem to, you know, major on the negativity around the green issues. But also, you know, some stories from themselves in terms of how they got involved in covering ecological issues. So perhaps if I could turn to you, Niall, and allow you to introduce yourself and say who you work for, how you got involved in, you know, ecological and climate reporting, and anything else you'd like to share with our listeners. So you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
For a few years while also doing environmental journalism, editing the greennews.ie, and now I am with the Noteworthy team, and I'm not just a climate environmental reporter within the team. However, so far all the investigations that have been funded and that I've worked on have been environmental, climate, or farming, or sustainability related in some way, shape, or form. So it's just fantastic to see the interest that the public have in those issues that they want to fund the investigations, because just very briefly, the way we work is we crowdsource ideas and then put out investigative ideas which are crowdfunded. So it's fantastic to see that the public have such an interest in these issues. So yeah, like it's, and just if I go very briefly, it's somewhat kind of interesting how my first interest in the environmental area, it's funny now I think back, I used to work in a previous life as an intelligence analyst at Interpol, and I was working in much different areas like organized crime elements, pharmaceutical crime, different areas. But the environmental crime team was sitting in the hallway across from me, and every day I was just constantly listening to their conversations because I was just so shocked at the issues that were going on globally, and realized I actually had a big interest in this area, not just watching nature documentaries and caring about what happened to animals, but, you know, deforestation, all these issues. I just couldn't believe it. And I guess looking back, that kind of sparked my interest that I didn't even realize at the time until 5 or so years later when I ended up with EcoEye and now today working on mostly environmental investigations. So wow. That's me. Anyway,
that's brilliant, Niall. Fascinating. We've got two areas of overlap before I allow Shauna in. One is that I taught Duncan Stewart's brother. Okay. Duncan Stewart is the main presenter for EcoEye, the programme that Niall was talking about. He's a very prominent QC in Dublin, and I taught him on a course many, many years ago. Maybe not quite as exciting as Niall. I did work for the Metropolitan Police back in the late 1980s. And so therefore had an insight into the ways in which the coercive arms of the state actually work. But I'm sure Niall had much, you know, more civilized interactions with this element of the state. But it is interesting, and something that we may get into, is that the existence of a border on this island means that we're wide open for cross-border crime, particularly environmental crime. You know, wherever there's a border, we do tend to find criminal activity. But that's something we may want to get into, this all-island dimensions, particularly of waste and contaminated waste management. But Shauna, who are you? Where do you work, and how did you get involved in green ecological climate news coverage?
Hi, I don't know how to follow either of those things, so I'll just do my best and hope it turns out all right. For me, it wasn't so exciting as working for Interpol. I kind of lived and worked in Manchester for an awful long time, went to Australia for a bit, then came back to Belfast and thought, right, need to get back into this. So off it trotted to Belfast Met, did my NCTJ, and just started out with local papers, really. And then it was while I was there, like, it was always sort of hard news and really, really loved the buzz of doing that. But this interest just sort of crept in for environmental issues, because looking around me, you know, whether they teach in journalism school, you should look at what's going on in the world around you. And just down the road, we had the Loch Ness sand extraction that had been happening for 70 years with absolute, you know, with no planning permission, no environmental impact assessments. And when I looked into this, I actually couldn't believe it and just sort of thought, this is mad that this is happening. And the government has just turned a blind eye to it. All the companies involved are just getting away with it and they're making huge profits. But, you know, we've got like all these species in the loch declining, but actually no sort of base mark to, you know, work off because they've been going on for so long. And then just down the road in the other direction, then you had the miners sort of land, and then you had issues with, I don't know, a certain company that does a lot of work for the department doing town regeneration schemes and dumping their waste here, there and everywhere without any waste licensing or anything in place. And I just kind of thought, I'm from Tyrone and it is a bit of, you know, it is a bit of a cowboy land and when it comes to things like this anyway, but you sort of expect that the government's going to step in or people are going to sort of, you know, stick to the regulations and all the rest of it. But there's just this attitude that, you know, we just pretend not to see it and then it's not really happening. And that's kind of where it was sparked for, you know, environmental stories for me. So from then I moved to Belfast Live and the Mirror in Northern Ireland, which is where I've been for just over, I think it's just over 5 years now. And even then, even though I moved from Tyrone to Belfast, came up the road, still sort of took that interest with me and kept pushing the environmental stories, even when it was like, no. We want something a bit more gritty. Like, I brought the gritty stuff too. I brought the crime. I brought everything else. But I just couldn't let go. And I just had to keep, you know, forging away for those stories because I just thought it was a really hugely underreported area and something that was becoming more and more important. So just ahead of COP, my big boss came to me and said, so how do you fancy becoming the environment correspondent? I think just because I tortured the life out of him for 5 years, he thought maybe there's nobody else really for this role. So, but then instead of just giving me the North, he's given me the Republic of Ireland too, which has been a huge learning curve. So now I'm the environment correspondent for Reach PLC, which is basically used to be called Trinity Mirror, which includes the Irish Mirror, the Irish Daily Star, Daily Mirror Northern Ireland. Then you've got all the online sites like Cork Bio, Galway Bio, Dublin Live, Belfast Live, and there's a few more, but we'll be here all day if I keep talking. So I'm happy to hand over now back to John.
I mean, it sounds like both of you really have, you know, a sense of the media as the fourth estate in a way of holding the powerful, whether that's in the business or the state, to account. But, you know, a common criticism, and I'd be interested in either of your responses on this, is that certainly the mainstream media have been slow behind the curve in, you know, really conveying the seriousness of what we're facing in terms of the sixth great mass extinction, the, you know, the climate crisis that we're facing. I mean, maybe get into the languaging around it and so on. So what's your own view as to why the media have been, you know, behind the curve in a way of promoting this as, in many respects, it should be the issue that should be top of our news bulletins almost every night, given the existential nature of it. So perhaps, Niall, I'll come to you. What's your own experience of what, you know, again, this is probably you reflecting on the people you're hanging around with, perhaps as fellow journalists and in the media world. What's the sense of how that's being understood within, you know, our news media, you know, culture?
I'd say in the last 3 years, there's been a definite shift. Like, I've really seen it compared to when I would have been research at EcoEye, and really kind of EcoEye was the only real thing for sort of more in-depth reporting on the issues and an understanding of how severe the climate crisis is. So, yeah, there was frustration maybe back then, 7-8 years ago. But definitely in the last 3-4 years, the school strikes made a massive difference. The importance of COP, the fact that things were happening around the world, coming closer and closer to Ireland, because I suppose the big issue is we have not seen the direct impacts really here. And that's tough for editors to understand the gravity of the situation, why this hits an Irish audience. But you know, I would have been frustrated at various times. You know yourself, when you're researching something so in-depth and you can see what's coming, this wall of information and this impending crisis that's going to be like nothing we've seen before, you kind of wonder, how does no one else see this? But you have to understand, in the media world, you know, journalists are on daily beats. They might be covering various areas that, and editors who, you know, are generalists might not be specialized, and they have to think about what's going to make the cover. Political stories always lead the front pages, and if not seen as a political issue, it might not get there. So, you know, it has really, I think, changed. And just from our own perspective for the journal media, like, I'm so happy to see, you know, they received training, I think, a few years ago from some academics in DCU about, like, sort of for the whole team about, you know, what this whole climate crisis is, not just for the reporters, but for, you know, accountancy department or marketing department, the editorial team. And now, especially since COP, the last COP, they saw, like, the editors really saw the interest in the subject. There was two reporters, maybe not full time, but two young female reporters who were putting a lot of their time into the issue. There's now a newsletter on climate that comes out every month from the journal. It now is a drop down, you know, in the banner, there's a climate drop down. And the fact that there's two reporters kind of more dedicated and focused on climate and biodiversity, and now the rest of the team following. And I was super inspired that only a few weeks ago, those two reporters gave sort of a climate crisis for the media presentation and training session for the whole editorial team and the reporters. And for me, I was so excited, because usually it's me who'd be doing that sort of thing. And it was great to see other reporters and hitting on all the things you're like, hitting on the most important points of, look, this is why we have to report this, not just from climate perspective, but, you know, across all news beats. And the final thing I'll finish on, why I think it's now hitting home, I think before, a lot of editors might have said, if you as a reporter like Sean and myself would come and say, look, you have to look at climate from every news beat. Like, if it's politics, if it's crime, if it's energy, it has to be looked at. If it's construction, if it's business. And before, it'd be like, look, we can't do that. Every news section has its own section and editorial basis. Then COVID came along and every news story became also a COVID story. There was the umbrella of COVID above it. And I think now editors and media in particular are seeing that the umbrella of climate reaches across all news arenas, and it has to form a basis of the reporting. And there's been a massive change. Like, the fact that Sean is provided that role, the fact you have Philip Boucher-Hayes having a second series of a climate-focused documentary series on RTE, like, these are big changes compared to several years ago. So I'm pretty positive about that, but the climate crisis is still coming, unfortunately. I wish we didn't have to report.
But Sean, I mean, a bit like, you know, what Niall was saying, how do you avoid that? I seem to find myself perpetually, you know, from that movie Don't Look Up, I am Jennifer Lawrence in that, you know, scene from the news, just saying, what the fuck, do you not realise what we're facing here? Why are we talking about shit? Why are we trying to put a smiley face on a disaster? And then I check myself and realise, well, now, John, that's probably one thought too many. You're saying the quiet part out loud in some ways. But it is that issue. How do you balance, you know, trying to communicate the severity and the urgency of what we're facing in a way that perhaps doesn't frighten people or bring litigation against you? So how do you balance that, Shauna?
Well, it is a tough ask. I mean, you know, when you go into it and you're sort of like, even when you look at the stats after, say, for example, you do a story, it goes online, people are going to click the stories that are all about Dublin underwater, Belfast underwater, Cork underwater. They're going to want to see, is my house going to be that part of the town that's underwater or that part of the city? So it's like, the challenge is to really make it relevant to them. And like listening to what Niall was saying, you know, you've got these stories from all around the world, and we're talking about drought and famine in the Horn of Africa, and we're talking about floods in Bangladesh and all these other countries, and people in Ireland are sitting going, well, you know what, that doesn't really impact me, so why should I stop using gas or burning turf or putting coal on the fire? But this summer, and I do agree with Niall that it has changed in recent years, and you have seen like a massive shift in mindsets from reporters that maybe 5-6 years ago were going, climate what? I don't really know what you're talking about, to now it is in their mindset. And I do think things like COP have been really helpful, but I do still think we've got some way to go, because you've got like a newsroom and a news organization is just like the rest of the world. You've got lots of different people with lots of different views and lots of different reporters competing for different column inches and all the rest of it. And it's about finding a balance between all those things. But also when you're reporting on climate issues, you're taking a hugely, hugely complex situation with so many different facets, and it's trying to put that into terms that people can digest easily. You know, like they read a story, it might tell them a bit about peat extraction and how that impacts us because we're losing our carbon sinks, or you might do a story about the weather, the extreme weather that we've had over the summer, and it's, you know, putting it down to them. And then the other challenge is when you get those messages out there and you've got editors now that are really taking this seriously and maybe giving you a double page spread where it maybe would have been jammed into a sidebar somewhere on page 23 before. Now you're getting, you know, really good coverage. You put it on social media and then you're getting massive backlash from people who still don't believe that it's happening. So it's just trying to win over the public. But I do think it is massively in everybody's mindset now. So for me, it's kind of a balance between trying not to depress the life out of people, but also trying to make them see that there are changes that they can make. And the more people that care about this and the more people that put pressure on the politicians to make the changes that are going to be needed to get us where we need to be to reduce our emissions. You know, change happens from the ground up, and we see that over and over again. And I think I sort of see my role as kind of reporting on the things that matter to the people that are out there that are looking at these things going, the future is really scary. What do we do about this? So for me,
to go across it, that really relates to, you know, something that both of you have done very, very, very well, and why I'm singularly ill-equipped as an academic to do what you do. We deal in abstract planetary big issues, macroeconomics, a lot of theory, you know, all evidence-based and so on. But, you know, your stock and trade is trying to, you know, as both of you said, trying to find a language that lands with people that they can understand, and also making it local. And I want to ask both of you about that challenge, you know, in terms of how do you, without dumbing down the science, which I don't think either of you would ever countenance, given the integrity that you have for the empirical realities of what we face. But the fact is that my profession, and particularly because I'm a social scientist, but our natural scientists are not very good communicators. Simply telling people the facts will not motivate them. So how do you navigate that, you know, the science-based world of, you know, biological diversity and the climate science and the language of greenhouse gas emissions and biomethane and all that stuff that, you know, the science is very good at and policy needs to guide it, but then to make it comprehensible for people. So I don't know where, no, start with you now, then go to Sean about that navigation between the science, which is very often abstract and often in a language that's quite, you know, obtuse to most people, and trying to make it then, you know, tangible and land with particularly ordinary citizens, but really localizing it, indigenizing it, you know, in some ways.
Yeah, I probably, compared to Sean, I'm probably very lucky in the sense of some of our articles, we can go with the 4,000-6,000 words if we need. So there's more space to expand on. Say you can have a paragraph explaining a complex issue, whereas, you know, if I was writing, say, in the Irish Times or elsewhere, and I have 400-800 words, it's more choice. You have to really find the way to convey it in a sentence, and that can be really tough. And you do always have that the sort of quandary of am I escaping the true meaning of this term or this issue by condensing it to one line. But you also have to understand, like I always tell, if I'm speaking with a biologist or a climate scientist, whoever it might be, an aquatic ecology specialist, I always say, look, one, you're talking to a journalist, so explain it very simply. But then also imagine a general audience who has never heard of this issue before. Explain it basically as if you're explaining something to a child to get them to understand the concept for the first time. And, you know, most people I interview are very happy to do that. Sometimes people are like, oh, it's not that easy. You can't break it down like that. And you just have to try to explain. If you can't, then the public are never going to understand this issue. Like, if it's so impossible, how can we get it across to a general audience that this is such an issue of importance? So you're kind of trying to navigate those by trying to be true to the science, trying to be respectful to, you know, respectful to the scientist or academic who may have put months to years of work into something, who have to use a certain type of language and terminology within their profession. While also balancing that with, okay, the public need to understand that, and how do I convey it? So I think for me, I try to balance it off, say maybe other members of my team or editors who don't know the subject, and be like, look, do you understand what I mean by that? And occasionally what I would do if I'm a bit unsure if I'm getting the true meaning of something, or if I think maybe have I dumbed this down too much or not got quite exactly the meaning, I can go back to someone, a specialist, and say, look, I'm not going to share my entire article with you, but this line is going to be in it. Is this factually correct? While also being digestible. And sometimes academics have come back and they've helped me maybe tweak a few words in it to make it even more digestible for a general audience while keeping true to the meaning. So it's kind of a tightrope. You kind of navigate those things, but it's definitely something I think about quite often. But we're lucky in the sense of sometimes, you know, you don't want to have too much explanation to get away from the story, because you need a good narrative to bring people along. But we're lucky in the sense we can maybe take a paragraph to explain an issue if we have to, which, you know, you're not always lucky to have the time or space, as much as maybe four or five thousand words is too long for some people to read, which I know for sure. But we're lucky in that we can go into that depth as well.
That's a breakfast read for me. That's my meat and drink, reading these long articles. And you're quite right, Niall, in terms of, I remember from my days as a local councillor that whenever we put out press statements, it was always, if you're explaining, you're losing. You know, you should be able to just communicate what it is, that it's so self-evident that people can, you know, get the essence of what you're trying to say. And indeed, I think you mentioned there about DCU coming along and giving briefings to yourselves as journalists. I think reciprocally, we in the academy, I think we need to have the expertise of people like yourself and Shauna to help us frame the language we're using, because God love us, most of us are probably functionally autistic in the sense that, you know, we work in a world with language that we've been doing for decades, and it makes sense to us and the people we talk to, but it doesn't make sense to ordinary people. But Shauna, what's your reflections on that, you know, balance between integrity to the science, which is often complex and off-putting, and then trying to create a narrative and a compelling story? Particularly given that perhaps you have more constraints than Niall in having a shorter amount of words within which to communicate that. How do you navigate that creative tension?
God, I would hate to see the editor's faces if I came in with 6,000 words. I feel the vibes at 800. They're like, what is this? You know, so for me, I think it's important, and I always try not to talk down to people. You know, I know you're always sort of trying to put a story in sometimes very complex issues into simple words that people can understand. But I think the key, and something that I always try and come back to, is to make it personal to people, because by our very nature, everybody lives in a bubble, don't they? They think about their mummy, their daddy, their partner, their granny, their granda, the people around them and the issues that kind of impact them. And God, I just think as well, life's so hard for people at the moment, you know, with the cost of living crisis and all these different things that they're up against. And climate change for a lot of people is just one more thing to think about, or biodiversity loss. They're thinking, well, does that mean I can't have my breakfast from McDonald's on a weekend with the sausages or whatever in it? And for me, it's always when I do a story and I know it's maybe something that people aren't going to care about as much, I kind of think about it in these terms. You know, what's the language, or where's the kind of the point where you can get them to care about it? If it's about animals, they're going to care about the conditions that they're kept in. If it's about the environment, it's bringing it back to something that's going to somewhere down the line impact them, you know, like carbon emissions are basically air pollution. Air pollution is killing hundreds of people a year, you know, both north and south of the border. So it's just about, for me, trying to get those messages across, but say, you know, this isn't something that's happening somewhere else that isn't going to impact you and your family or the people you care about. This is something that you should be worried about. So I try to do that. Sometimes maybe it works, sometimes maybe it doesn't work, but it, you know, it's always, every day is a school day and I'm always learning and I'm always open to, you know, feedback on places that I can do better.
And just to push that idea out, I mean, just to throw open a question for both of you, and it's long been a concern of mine. I mean, what would both of you say that often green environmental issues are woke, guilty, educated, urban middle class issues, and that actually for a lot of ordinary working class people, this is not a concern? The language, the issue, it's almost, you know, I'm not going to say it's part of a culture war, but it, you know, what would you say to that perception that green issues are really, you know, guilty, educated, woke concerns that don't really connect with particularly working class people? So I don't know whether, Niall, whether or not that's something you have a response to, or you've seen it, or it's not really where you would view what green politics is about.
Yeah, I would say probably, at least from a media perspective, those sort of ideas are very heavily picked up within, I suppose, the political reporting or political conversation. So you get maybe Eamon Ryan saying something in the Dáil, followed by one of the Healy Rays or someone from the Rural Alliance, let's say, of TDs. And they're obviously very different conceptions of the issue, and very, and in many ways, you know, they're coming from different constituencies that have different transport infrastructure, different incomes, etc. So you can see where the clash might be. But I think it's often then reported kind of in the media, in the political pages, of this rural urban divide, which, look, some of the ideas obviously that have probably come out over the years from on the sort of environmental side would be more geared towards a more Dublin centric idea in terms of that's where the emissions are from, particularly from housing, from transport and those issues. So I think it's the transportation side often gets picked up about cycle lanes and better infrastructure of the Lewis and the rail and things like that. Whereas, of course, rural Ireland, like even where I am, we're calling out for more trains, more connection between different villages so you don't have to drive everywhere. That can be missed. But I think there's a narrative that's kind of been created, maybe that the media, we haven't always helped to supplant. But at its core, for me, if you look at the issues, they are working class issues, like, and middle class issues, because I just take myself, and, you know, I would see myself as coming from a privileged background, you know, and I've never had it. I've had a fairly easy life as I see it. But where I'm living now, we want to retrofit. We're lucky to be, you know, in home ownership now since last year. But even for us now with the new grants for retrofitting, we're still trying to figure out where we're going to get the money, and the fact that the low interest loans are not really low interest loans still. So those are the struggles you're facing in the real world that sometimes I think gets missed when, you know, stuff comes out, say, from whatever political party that says, oh, look, there's these fantastic new extra retrofitting grants, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone should be able to do it now, sort of. That's the conception that's portrayed, whereas these things are still incredibly expensive, and they hit those on the lower economic rung the hardest. Like, you know, who's going to be living in smaller, older houses? More than likely working class. And these are the effects. Who's hit by the just transition? Midlands working class people, predominantly in Ireland. So, you know, you have to take those things into account. And in terms of the media, you know, I don't think it's as divisive as maybe it's been portrayed in maybe the front pages of newspapers sometimes, of the rural urban divide. And I think a lot of we can't, I suppose, as media, we have a responsibility to make sure we're not creating that sort of narrative, because as much as I'm saying the grants might not be currently enough, they're still pretty generous, you know, compared to what they could be. So we also have to, I think, as we have a responsibility to tell people, look, these are still pretty good. They're not going to cover everything. They're not fantastic, but these are efforts that are aimed at helping people on the lower rungs of society as well, which are unfortunately those are the workers, those are the communities that are going to be hardest hit by the impacts of climate change.
I mean, there's a lovely phrase from a Brazilian trade union activist, a conservationist called Chico Mendes, that you both may have heard of, who basically said, environmentalism without class politics is gardening, in terms of seeing that there is a class politics here that you've been touching upon, Niall. But what about you, Sean? Like, you know, obviously, it's a different context perhaps here in the north, but perhaps not that different in terms of that perception that you perhaps would have as a journalist. Not that you would have it, but you know, in engaging with people, maybe editors or even readers or people you interview, that green politics is a kind of an added extra. You know, as somebody once said, it's hard to think about the end of the world when you can't think about the end of the week in terms of, you know, struggles that people have. So I wonder what you would have to, you know, your reflections on that issue of, you know, class, privilege and green issues.
Well, I think it's sort of the notion that it's a sort of middle class ideal has been used as a stick to kind of beat down any idea that it doesn't impact every cross section of society. The environment's coming for us all. Climate change is coming for us all. And maybe in a roundabout sense, you know, rural communities, like I grew up in Tyrone in the middle of nowhere, well, just outside a well-known, very working class town. So, you know, not everybody that writes about the environment is from the middle classes or the top classes of society. And, you know, you can see in the stream at the end of your road, you can see the waste and how that all impacts and everything else. And there are people within those communities that do care. All you have to do is take a look around Belfast and look at the alley gates that have been put up so people can have little gardens in between their houses and the neighbours' houses. You know, you've got schemes in West Belfast where they're looking at uniform sort of, here you go, have some free uniforms or have some secondhand uniforms to help people with the cost of sending their kids back to school. And as much as people might say that's a money thing, it's also an environment thing. You know, you've got gardening groups and different community groups doing things like they're helping people grow vegetables and learn how to do all those things. So these things are happening and they are taking root in working class communities. And I think we need to get away from this idea that to make these changes, it's going to be expensive. If we make the changes that are actually going to bring us into the future and help reduce our emissions and, you know, reduce some of the impacts of the climate crisis, we need to be looking at what we do to help those lower class communities or, sorry, working class communities. You know, like we need to insulate their homes. In the South, they're very, very lucky. They've got this retrofit scheme and this grant scheme and everything else. There is nothing like that even being discussed up here. We don't even have a working government at the moment. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, to throw out 400 quid for people that are on the dole saying, here you go, this is going to help you with your £5,000 gas bill next year, is completely like of another level. But the way I see it is all these issues are interlinked. And you're right, Niall, you know, working class people are going to be hit hardest by this. People that can't work because of health issues or for work, whatever other issues, are going to be completely annihilated by this. People that need to have their electricity on for, you know, if they're sick at home and all the rest of it. So if we can put in place the things that need to be in place to help those people, it's going to help the climate. It's going to help them in their day-to-day life and help them to get to the end of the week, but also to help us get through the next 50 years in a much, much better way. And I think it would be really helpful if the media at large started reporting on it like that, rather than business as usual. And obviously this is a very personal opinion. I do write a column as well, so I have been known to roll out an opinion an odd time. But I mean, this idea that it should be, we're still developing, we're still doing this, you can't take the turf away from those communities. We need to be going into those communities and saying, but if you do it this way, it's going to be cheaper, you're not going to be breathing in fumes, and you know, we'll find jobs for those people in a renewable sector rather than, you know, still looking to develop and use fossil fuels when we know it's so bad for all of us.
I mean, I'd be interested in both of your views, particularly given, you know, you're talking to ordinary citizens, policymakers, politicians, academics and so on. about your sense of, is there a realization, at least among some sections of our population, of the severity of the challenge and how radical the transformations are going to have to be for us to be able to successfully meet, you know, which I don't think we're going to do, the 1.5 degree Paris Accord. I think that's gone. You know, we have to recognize we're going to live now in a climate changed world. But I'm interested from your own, you know, reporting and so on. Is there a sense, maybe it's growing now, as Niall said, of the really, and I'm talking kind of functional transformational changes. I'm not talking about ideologically driven changes that we're going to make because we're driven by some ideology. Is that purely the science, as you know, the IPCC that both of you probably be aware of? I mean, in its reports from this year, I mean, it's pretty stark. I mean, for me, reading those reports is the equivalent of the world scientists screaming at the top of their voice, saying, for feck's sake, will you please move quickly and fast? But I'm just interested in both your senses from the work that you've been involved in. Is there, you know, maybe an unevenly distributed recognition of the absolutely radical changes that we're going to have to institute across all sectors of society within the next couple of decades to be able to move to a less unsustainable, I wouldn't say a more sustainable, let's just say a less unsustainable system. So maybe I'll start with you, Niall.
I think it's, from my experience, it's probably kind of a mixed bag. Like, I do feel people are more awake to the issues now and the understanding, in part because of what they're seeing reported more in the media now and what's happening, I suppose, closer to home as the heat waves are getting, you know, with our own here, but particularly when people saw what happened in London when it, you know, hit 40 there, and the, like, thinking, okay, are we next maybe? But like, it has, as that's becoming closer, I think there's been a progression with more reporting on the COP and the IPCC reports, on even the biodiversity reports, the IPBES reports getting more attention now as well. Citizens Assembly made a massive difference. You could see that when people are, when the facts and the science is clearly laid out in a digestible, straightforward manner for people, they get it. And the, what, you know, the decisions they made at that Citizens Assembly was incredible. And I'm quite sure there will be similar results from the one on biodiversity now. So there's a big change there in that general. But I would say we're talking a bit about sort of the local issues. Like, I find in so many cases there are so many people on a local level who don't even know they're environmentalists or that they're climate activists. They're just might be interested in, like Sean was saying, maybe a local grow your own scheme, or they might have, it could be, you know, a taxi driver in a state who notices an issue and where he goes for his walk on a river, there's been some sort of contamination. Some, you know, people you might not expect to be, they might not have a big idea on the overarching issues, but they know particularly to theirs. I find lots of ideas for stories and stories come from anglers because they're out in the rivers, you know, every day. They see the contamination, they see the pollution. It might be someone who, you know, is looking for a better future for their kids in their area, and they don't want a plastic factory being built by their house or an incinerator going close to them. And they start to learn the science from a, you know, a very sort of clearly a very personal standpoint, but they learn through that way. So it's kind of a mix. A lot of people come to it by accident, but then more generally people are engaged. And just, I suppose, media, we have a responsibility just on, and as well what Shauna was touching on there, sort of, you know, it's how we sort of frame it or to talk about certain issues. And I think, you know, we do have a responsibility and how we get it across to people, the severity of it, and that it's going to cost a lot, but it's going to cost a lot more not to act. You know, we often, from an economic perspective, it's, there's this idea for a new scheme or this thing coming in, but it's going to cost you this much as a taxpayer, or where are you going to find that money? Rather than asking the question like, okay, can we continue perpetual economic growth on a finite planet? Like, that just does not make sense. But we don't necessarily ask those questions in the economics pages of newspapers yet. And it's that shift we also have to look at. The cost of inaction has to be looked at much more heavily than, oh, this is going to cost X amount in your taken out of your paycheck every week to let people retrofit their homes or whatever. We have to think about it in a different way and inform the public in a fair manner on those issues. Yeah.
Well, speaking as a science-based post-growth economist, who struggles enormously trying to get the BBC to take what I want to say on their programmes seriously. It is a major issue, and I do want to come back to growth and capitalism and why we don't really see that discussion in our media. But before we get there, Shauna, what's your sense of the people you're engaging with, the stories, the work that you're doing, of people realizing that this is not a normal policy issue, that technology perhaps ain't going to save us, although we're going to need technology, but that we're talking about, you know, major changes in how we heat, how we eat, how we transport, and this, you know, sense of a full spectrum, if you like, transformation of our societies. Do you get a sense that that is beginning to land with people, or what sections of people that you're talking to?
In Dublin, yes. In Belfast, no. I don't even think we're close, honestly. I mean, you can see the difference in the policy, both north and south of the border, even though we all share an island. Even looking at, like, doing a real deep dive into sort of policies and strategies that the executive had pumped out last year, you know, you've got your green growth strategy. What is green growth? You know, we had Going for Growth, which started in 2012, which saw our agriculture industry just, you know, boom to the point that we're feeding 10 billion people in an area that holds 1.9 million people, and nobody can seem to grasp the fact that this might be a problem, and the ammonia emissions and the nitrates and everything that comes with that has, you know, wreaked havoc with our rivers or lakes or water, everything. But you've still got this mentality within some sections of Stormont where it should just be continued growth, continued growth, continued growth, no matter the cost. You know, we have got a massive issue with how we are, you know, heating our homes and with the electricity supply and stuff. And we've got nowhere near the amount of wind farms that are in the south. We're not even sort of to the level where we're talking about offshore wind to the same scales or anything like that. You know, that then you've got companies coming in with these big ideas about, well, why don't we build hydrogen, and we can build massive big hydrogen storage tanks, even though that was originally meant to be for gas in the first place. But there's all these technological solutions being pushed out there, and there's nothing to back it up. And it kind of makes you think, as I say, you're as a sensible person going into a room full of people, and it's kind of like some of these ideas, you just think they're a bit pie in the sky, instead of like, why don't we just pull back a little bit and decide not to try and just generate as much money as we possibly can out of everything? Because, you know, the UK Climate Change Committee said we need to reduce our meat consumption in Northern Ireland by 20%. And I can imagine that went down like a lead balloon with the Ulster Farmers Union and, you know, other vested interests. And I think, you know, we really need to take a step back and have a really good hard look at all these lobby groups that are sort of in the background, you know, talking in politicians' ears and saying, you know, like, this isn't going to be good for business if we change building regulations to make all of our new buildings rate for, you know, energy efficiency. That's going to cost us more to build those homes. But they're not really thinking about the end outcome there. They're not really thinking about the people on the receiving end of those new properties and the prices they're going to have to pay for fossil fuel, gas and oil and all the rest of it. So I think, you know, Niall is right in that it's a mixed bag. And I think overall, it's a huge, huge challenge for the whole government. But I just think our government the Stormont government has a really long way to go to actually look at those different areas all in sort of like bite-sized chunks and think, right, this is the problem. How do we solve this? This is the problem here. How do we solve this? And I think in Dublin, they're doing a lot better, although I don't know, with the kind of the new push for gas and everything else like that, and natural gas potentially coming from America, even though the rules are that we don't accept fracked gas. I know that's becoming a huge issue, and fossil fuels are sort of back on the table after the war in Ukraine and supply disruptions and all the rest of it. And I think that could have been a great opportunity to sort of speed up the renewables and speed up that sort of area and really, really look at making huge numbers of jobs in that area to help with the just transition. So I think we're halfway there, but there's a hell of a long way to go.
I mean, I'm curious that both of you have kind of mentioned about something that's very close to my academic heart, which is, you know, the critique of orthodox GDP growth. I mean, you can't have perpetual growth on a finite planet, as Niall said. But of course, growth is a structural condition of capitalism. And what I mean by that is simply a description of our current political economy and the way the economy is organized. So I'm interested in why you think, both of you, you know, from your own analyses, why don't we see discussions of capitalism and growth? You know, we see that with focus on carbon and maybe business interests, as you mentioned there, Shauna. But is there a sense that both of you feel that we do need to start having media discussions? And not that you're taking a stance on it, but just at least raise the issue that the structure of our economies based around perpetual growth is a function of a capitalist, you know, economy, particularly under neoliberalism after the last 30 years. So why don't we see more interrogation of growth, or indeed even the mere mention of capitalism and the fact that there are non-capitalist ways of organizing our economy? And it doesn't mean we have to go back to communism and the Soviet Union. That's the kind of go-to position. So I wonder, from your own experience, is there an allergic reaction to talking about capitalism, never mind talking about economic growth in discussions of the climate and ecological crisis? So I'll turn to you first, Niall, and then Shauna.
I would say, like, in broad terms, maybe across society, I think this or the system in place at the moment is, I think there's a perception that it is, if you talk like for a generalist person, we might say, okay, how long do you think the current economic model has been in place? Forever. You know, I think it's just that people are so adjusted that this is the way things are done, that if there's a conception that, you know, we need to have a contraction and economic contraction on purpose, or we need to slow down growth purposefully, that just does not make sense, because we have been told, all of us from, you know, a young age, that this is how the economic model works, but we're never told that you should also think about the resources that are required for the economic system to take place and the impacts that can have, particularly, say, you know, growth of businesses here can have an impact halfway across the world in terms of the resources required for the infrastructure, et cetera, for that growth. So I think it's a very difficult conception for many people to think there are alternatives, or that there could be a negative impact of where we're going, especially in Ireland, when you look at, you know, apart from obviously the recent crash, which kind of shook the system a bit, but that people see the growth again, and there's a connection there with that system. And I suppose it's kind of that the issue that happens then, because the system is so embedded, then you have systems in place that, you know, I found this, you know, obviously it's not, you really report on it as such in when you're looking at an investigation, maybe at specific companies or specific industries, but I do see a theme across many areas I've looked at that a lot of industries that are having fairly strong environmental or climate impact, maybe multi-million or multi-billion euro industries, they've gone in such a direction that in order for the players, the smaller players within an industry, say if it's farmers within the poultry sector, to continue to make profit within that current system, they have to keep expanding and expanding, because the prices are getting lower and lower for what they're producing. Because the system, obviously, you know, there is a need for profit for the largest companies in the end of the chain, let's say, if it's processors or supermarkets, as we see. So you have the farmers getting squeezed, that the only way for them to actually continue to make profit is to expand their operations. And I've seen this across many industries I've looked at that are having a very significant environmental impact. And you see it reflected in, like Shauna touched on that there, the I think what's the Going for Green, or whichever the latest agricultural policy, which completely parallels the agri expansion policies in Ireland, which, you know, are pushing dairy expansion. And I suppose just finally, within that conception, you obviously have like the Jevons paradox, which is you're within that model, you're increasing your efficiencies, but we within that model, you say, OK, increasing efficiencies means things are cheaper, or we're getting lower emissions per product, particularly in Ireland, per cow. But you're continuing to expand, therefore the emissions are continuing to rise. So, you know, the planet doesn't think in efficiencies. The planet thinks in absolute emissions. And I think, you know, I think maybe in terms of for reporters or media, we have to think about that more, rather than, like I said, asking the questions of, oh, this is going to cost this much, or it'll impact these jobs within this industry. We also have to think of, is expansion going to injure the planet to such an extent that we're all going to lose those jobs anyway. So yeah, we have a role, but obviously wider society that we're in, that narrative has been created, and I think it's very difficult maybe to shift people's understanding about it.
Just to pick up, the professor in me wants to just briefly mention the Jevons paradox for listeners that may not be familiar with it. And essentially it is that energy savings or resource savings from a usually technological innovation, which reduces carbon emissions or reduces water consumption, all those savings can be wiped out if the savings are then often used in other forms of consumption. So the classic example is cars now that are being produced in the 21st century are invariably much more resource and energy efficient than cars built in the 1960s and 70s. But here's the problem. We're now driving more and we own more cars. So in other words, all the savings on the production side are being wiped out by our failure to manage consumption. And in a way, that is an area that politicians don't want to go in terms of managing or governing consumption. But again, it's an endemic part of a capitalist growth-based system to get us to be, you know, consuming more and more. And just before I come to you, Sean, just to frame perhaps this issue of why don't we see discussions of capitalism and growth? Because it seems to me, as an educator, every year I see young people in particular who can more easily imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. You know, it's exactly as Niall said, this is the only economic system. They think it's been there for forever, when really, in reality, is at most maybe 40 years old in this current form. But from the media point of view, is it laziness? Is it ideological bias? Is it, oh God, it's too difficult? It's so boring to talk about capitalism and growth. But if we can agree that it's part of the story here, that it's not just about carbon. Carbon is only, you know, one step in the sequence. Well, what's causing the burning of carbon? It's not that people woke up one day and said, let's burn a ton load of carbon. There's an economic incentive, there's profits to be made, and so on. So is that issue? Why do you think that we don't see, in my view, sufficient discussion of capitalism and its alternatives, economic growth and its alternatives, when in particular we have the science, which in my view is telling us we need to start moving beyond both growth and capitalism?
I think a lot of people sort of think this is one of those conversations that's had a way up here, you know, with philosophers and think tanks. And like, I think Rutger Bregman wrote a great book called Utopia for Realists, and it spoke all about the dawn of capitalism after the Second World War, and after people having so little, then they were able to sort of go out and forge their own path and make companies and make money. And it's just this, it's kind of going back to the idea of the American dream, isn't it? You know, like, I can be that person that goes out there and works hard and has the great car and the great house and sends my kids to great schools and all the rest of it. But, you know, we've now come to a point where, you know, Ireland, maybe 100 years ago, most people grew up on their own smallhold farm. They had chickens in the backyard and they had a few pigs, maybe a cow for some milk and all the rest of it. People owned their own houses. They had a small plot. And over the years, sort of, you've seen these big companies come in and they buy up this bit of land and they buy up that bit of land. And now we've got a position where, you know, young people coming up through the ranks can't afford to get on the property ladder at all, whereas their grandparents were basically born and handed a house. So, you know, for them, I think it's just that idea that it has always been like that. But, and I hold my hands up here and I'll say I probably don't talk about it an awful lot because I'm just lost with economics and I'm lost with anything sort of money related. And I think that the systems become so complicated as to sort of, like, a bit like the legal system, it kind of like wards off any discussion about it because they're like, well, you know, you talk about recessions and you talk about inflation and you talk about interest rates going up. And then, you know, I had a chat with a bank manager one day and he said to me, there is no finite amount of money. I grew up as a kid thinking there's this much money in the world. And once it's all divvied up among everybody that lives in it, and once it's done, it's done. And then I realized the banks just keep printing it. And my mind was blown. And, you know, it's like those sorts of things that people aren't really aware of. They're not really aware of the economic systems and the changes that we we need to be making. But, you know, then you've got the Fridays for Future guys. They're calling for system change, not climate change. And, you know, it does pay to pollute the environment, and then you're paying someone else to come along and clean up after the mess that this other dude's made. So capitalism helps environmental destruction, and we've been seeing that for the last 50, 60 years. And you're right, we do need to have a discussion about it, but I just don't know where you start with that.
Well, I'll tell you where you start. You start by listening to our sister broadcast, our podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything, that is curated by Trademark Belfast, and they demystify inflation. And that realization that you've had, Shauna, is that there is no finite money supply. In fact, most governments do not need to raise taxes or engage in austerity to have the finance to do the things they need. They create the money by producing it. Yes, there are issues around inflation and so on, but anyway, that's probably for a separate broadcast, but it is, you know, an important issue to raise, and I absolutely appreciate it. It's easier in the academic context to talk about the history of capitalism, neoliberalism, you know, the Anthropocene, all of these terms that we have, which, you know, aren't going to really, you know, be connected to ordinary people. But I'm conscious of time. It's not only the planet that's finite, but also our time of a Tuesday evening. I do want to ask you two last questions or areas before we sign off. One is the stories you're currently or planning to work on, and is there a theme to them that you can see yourself doing more stories in this area the year ahead? And then a final question. So maybe, Niall, I mean, are there, what's on your agenda for the next, you know, wee while in terms of the stories you're going to cover?
Yeah, we've got a nice pipeline of investigations to work on. So I'm just finishing up one that I know Shauna covered very, very well recently as well on the live export trade. So I'll have a few articles coming out on that soon. So that's a live export trade in animals from Ireland to the European Union, predominantly in unweaned calves a few weeks old. And then also on older cattle going to third countries, mostly in North Africa by, you know, specialized vessels. So we're going to look at the two sort of trade routes and welfare concerns within the industry, but also kind of like why the industry is seen as important for Irish farming and what future does it have unless those welfare concerns are examined in more detail. So we're going to look at that. It's coming out soon. When I'm back, I'm off this week, but it should be coming out soon enough when I'm back. And then I'll start on two new projects. So one is looking at that hot topic at the moment of the energy crisis. So basically, how the hell did we get here? And we're going to look, you know, obviously, you can't look at the issue without looking at data centers as well. So we're going to examine that issue. And then one that's, I guess, is not necessarily climate related, but there might be something in there. I'm going to look at depopulation of small island nations off the Irish coast as part of a cross-border project working on with journalists in Scotland and Italy. So we're going to look at, like, why is there a common themes between them? And, you know, there could be some elements in there of, you know, environmental or climate issues on those islands. Maybe, you know, one thing that might play into, there's some islands who are, you know, doing quite well is because they have energy cooperatives and bringing employment back to the island. So, you know, there's always an element there, I guess. Energy is going to be one thing I'll be looking at in the future. And then we luckily, and like I said at the start, there is a big interest because there's a few other climate related proposals that we have on the cards that are very close to funding. So if people want to check out and help them get funded, noteworthy.ie, have a look.
Absolutely. And I highly recommend you. I'm now channeling my 1980s Irish Leaving Cert curriculum. And I remember a poem that really struck me called "On Tillon Treata," which is the abandoned island. I don't know which island it was talking about. And also then, you know, the old Peg Sayers that we all had to read. Maybe I'm showing my age now in terms of the Blasket Islands becoming depopulated. But on the positive news story, the Isle of Egg in Scotland is an example, Niall, of what you're talking about. They have a community-owned renewable energy facility, and that has reinvigorated tourism and industry and so on. So there's definitely something around that energy and connection with island populations. But Shauna, if I could turn to you, what's on your agenda for the next wee while in terms of stories, themes, topics that you're looking for?
Well, of a few sort of in the pipeline, I'm kind of looking at renewables. At the moment, where we are actually at, how many wind farms we've got, how many solar panels and all the rest of it, because we've seen quite a few reports come out about how we could do so much better. So I just really wanted to take a good hard look at both North and South, really, you know, how well we're doing and how much more we need to do. And I think it's by 2030, we've got to meet all the sort of targets and everything for it. So that's one thing. I get a lot of sort of tips about stories happening here, there and everywhere, and a huge recurring theme for me the last while has been trees. So I'm going to take a good hard look at deforestation and afforestation policies, why we're still sticking these massive pine trees into bogs and all the rest of it, and that kind of thing, and you know, when it's ruining the biodiversity of those areas, and we actually need to be looking at doing a better job of protecting our bogs. I know that there was some good news a few weeks ago about the 80 million for restorations and all the rest of it, but I mean, I think there's a huge issue with the forestry issue, pesticides. We're still using pesticides flat to the mat, and I just think that's crazy when we know the damage that it causes. So that's kind of on the radar as well. And then I've a few stories just teetering with legal, trying to get them over the line, just making sure all the I's are dotted and the T's crossed. So I'll not talk too much about those just until
no, we don't want you to stray at that of litigation. Not that you would, but it's interesting that, you know, and you probably know this, Shauna, that the Committee on Climate Change that you mentioned already, in its analysis of Northern Ireland, we have the unique feature, a failure, that land use and forestry is a net producer of carbon in Northern Ireland, whereas in most parts, you would imagine trees and land and particularly bogs would be sequestering carbon. So we're completely going the wrong direction in that way. Mm-hmm. So I wish you all the best with that work on land use and forestry. The last question I want to ask you both is one, you know, 2050 is a date in the future that is, it's kind of around, you know, net zero by 2050, a lot of UN, IPCC reports, and we all seem to be aiming at this future in 2050. Could I ask you both, you know, what you think we're going to be seeing in 2050 in terms of our societies, our food system, energy, assuming of course that we make it, you know, we always have to hold open the possibility that we won't. But perhaps if I come to you first, Niall, the year is 2050. What are you writing about? What's going on, whether it's good, bad or indifferent, dystopia or utopia in terms of, you know, looking ahead, you know, almost 30 years?
Yeah, I think probably one thing that we do very good in journalism is looking back and when something bad happens and saying, God, why didn't you guys in power did something 20, 30 years ago, and reflecting on that, not reflecting on why didn't we report about these issues 20, 30 years ago. So I think in terms of maybe the media landscape, there are probably examinations of past policies about why we weren't better for flood defences, storm surges, why we had a certain type of forestry policy, knowing potentially the issues that could, you know, it can exacerbate landslides of bogs and things as if issues continue to happen in that regard. So I think there might be from the media a lot of looking back and saying, how did we allow ourselves to get into this situation? And sorry, it's been very negative, but I would also see probably a big discussion in terms of farming, because I can't see us steering the ship in a different direction based on policy, based on, you know, the strength of the agricultural lobby or representative organizations in Ireland and the strength of that industry for jobs in particular, and how it's interlinked with forestry and a lot of other, you know, issues because of who owns the land, etc. So I think there'll be big discussions there, maybe like you're having in the Netherlands currently and for the last 5-10 years, of the realization that things have to change dramatically. I don't think we'll have maybe a shifted agricultural system. There will be diversification there. There will have to be more organic. We'll have better transportation infrastructure, I think. There'll probably still be debates about how many more billion it costs to build a Metro North or whatever it is, and, you know, compared to what we said, like the broadband plan now. So there'll be all those, I think, classic discussions. But I hope they'll be about maybe instead of about a motorway, they'll be about a, you know, a rail infrastructure, or, you know, about new cycle lanes going in and the cost of them. But I think the big one will still be agriculture, combined with obviously the issues we will see impacting us in Ireland. And I think the media will be better at reflecting, you know, why didn't we make those changes sooner, and looking back at those issues.
I think you're right. As I often say to my students, I often say to my students that we can imagine a post-industrial society, but we can never ever imagine a post-agricultural one. And it's something that we really do have to take more cognizance of, given, you know, particularly with the war in Ukraine and the, you know, supply chains being disrupted and so forth, that we're very, well, both energy and food insecure, despite the fact that the IFA down south and the UFU up here in the north like to, you know, present as a great achievement that we're, you know, producing monocrops of dairy and beef and exporting it to the world. So I definitely think the issue of food will be significant. But Shauna, you know, what do you think? The year is 2050. You're still hale and hearty. You're still a journalist. You're working on stories. What do you think are the stories that you'd be working on, or what do you hope to see in 2050?
In an ideal world, I hope I'm writing success stories, honestly. I hope I'm writing about how we've managed to insulate every house, how we've got wind turbines in every community, and, you know, bills have gone down for everybody. And I don't know, like, maybe we'll even be talking about, with the loss of jobs and the just transition and everything else, some people are getting a weekly wage or a monthly wage from the government just for being here, you know. So you can hope for all those things, but I think with my reality hat on, I think there will still be arguments, you know, down the line, and we'll still be discussing, and there'll still be this constant, you know, friction between business and everything else. And I don't know, like, I want it to be happy, and I want it to be, I want us to keep it below two at the very least, but the way things are going, I don't really have massive faith that politicians and world leaders are going to deliver for us if we just keep continuing on the track that we have been. You know, you can't have many more red alerts and alarms being sounded from here, there and everywhere, and then in the end of it all, the government, they go off and they make all these huge promises at COP, and when they come home, the decisions that they're making completely fly in the face of what they've said in front of the world over there. So I kind of hope at some point something's going to happen. There's going to be a shift where society maybe even sort of kind of catches on and looks at the way we're heading and says, you know what, we've had enough of this. We're sick of working for the shareholders. We're sick of, you know, slogging our guts out when cavemen, what they put in like 15 hours a week just to feed themselves. You know, the world we live in now is probably harder than it was back then, even though they probably spent half their time running for their lives. So I kind of hope, and I really, really hope for a hopeful future and a good and pleasant 2050 where half the world isn't underwater or burning. But I mean, watch this space. God knows what's going to happen.
I mean, on the one hand, we could be the first species that accurately document our own demise. I mean, yeah. Nobody can say that we didn't know. We've had the science that's increasingly robust over many years. But on the other side, I often think that what we often lack at this moment is creativity and imagination. You know, is that there's a real sense that of people stuck in a kind of business as usual. There's an inability perhaps to see that the transition that's ahead of us is an exciting prospect, you know, that we could be creating a much, much better world, as both of you have described in different ways. But I'm also mindful, just to end before I thank you both, there's a wonderful phrase from the great American feminist Gloria Steinem. And it's basically the importance of truth, which we know that we get from science. But the truth may set you free, as the good book says, but not before it pisses you off. Is that, you know, we have to fully recognize that there's not going to be an easy transition. You know, obviously we want to try and make it better at the other end, but we're going to have to relearn and redo and retool, you know, a lot of the things that we take for granted in our society. And it is a different type of society, perhaps, that we're looking at. It's better, but it is different. Maybe it is about, as you mentioned, Sean, a much more localized energy ownership, people growing their own food, maybe even a three-day working week, maybe staycations are the norm, and this more recent desire for us to fly around the world and so on, that is no longer possible. But is that a really big sacrifice when the context is that we're going to secure the lives and a habitable earth for ourselves and our children? But listen, folks, that's been absolutely fascinating for me, certainly as an academic. It's a masterclass in the language and framing that we need to be thinking about in terms of communicating these complex issues. So can I thank you both, Sean Accor and Niall Sargent. This has been the ABCs of Green Politics, part of the Left Bloc Political Education Project. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Take care now. Bye-bye.